the headlines as the U.S.'s radio genocide in Gaza enters its 159th day. UNRWA says the onslaught has claimed more lives of children than in 4 years of conflict around the world. The situation in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is getting tense as Israeli forces escalate their deadly crackdown on Palestinians during the month of Ramadan. And also in our headlines, the Israeli military conducts a drone attack on a car in southern Lebanon, killing at least two civilians there. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. A top story, the American-Israeli genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza is now in its 159th day with the regime pounding areas with warplanes and artillery across the besieged territory. The latest Israeli airstrike hit residential areas in Rafah, the southern city where nearly 1.5 million displaced people are enduring extremely dire conditions. Additionally, the regime's airstrikes targeted areas in the central city of Deir al-Balah, the Jabalia refugee camp, and the southern city of Khan Yunis were struck as well. The health ministry in Gaza says nearly 31,300 Palestinians have been killed since the war began in early October. Most of those killed are women and children. The UN says the number of Palestinian children killed during the first 4 months of the war on Gaza has topped those killed in 4 years of conflicts across the globe. Well, the UN says the number of Palestinian children killed during the first 4 months of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza has topped those killed in 4 years of conflicts across the globe. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, made the remark in a post on his X account. Philip Lazzarini said, the UN figures show that around 12,200 children have been killed in conflicts worldwide between 2019 and 2022. That's while, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, more than 12,300 Palestinian children have been slaughtered since early October. The UNRWA chief has also said that what's going on in Gaza is a war on children, their childhood, and their future. New foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell says Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war against Palestinians in Gaza. He made the remarks as he addressed the United Nations Security Council members on Tuesday.
And when you look what's happening, you may doubt about it. I don't want to teach any one of you about what is happening in Gaza. 30,000 people dead, 1.8 million displaced, 500,000 people on the brink of starvation. We are facing now a population fighting for their own survival. Humanitarian assistance needs to get into Gaza, and the European Union is working as much as we can in order to make it possible. But this is a humanitarian crisis which is not a natural disaster. It's not a flood. It's not a earthquake. It's a man-made. And when we look for alternative ways of providing support by sea or by air, we have to remind that we have to do it because the natural way of providing support through roads is being closed, artificially closed. And starvation is being used as a war arm.
On the first day of the holy month of Ramadan, thousands of Jordanians rallied in Amman and across the country to protest against Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
Today, on the first day of Ramadan, we are standing before the genocide, the enforced hunger and killing, the targeting of children, women, and unarmed civilians, and the demolition of houses over inhabitants. Of course, our message is to create a humanitarian land corridor to northern Gaza, where the Palestinian citizens suffer from hunger and dehydration inflicted by the Zionist enemy that is leading this offensive war, this genocide and ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian people.
Carrying Palestinian flags and banners, the protesters chanted pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel slogans. They also demanded unhindered delivery of aid to Gaza as they gathered near the Israeli embassy. Jordan, that is hosting 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed several rallies in solidarity with Gazans since Israel launched its war on the besieged strip. Similar rallies have taken place in other countries as well.
As the crescent moon marks the beginning of the Muslims' holy month of Ramadan, Millions across Pakistan have declared their intention to dedicate this month to the oppressed people of Gaza. Among those joining in this noble cause are Abdullah Khalid and his family. Recognizing the sufferings of the Palestinian brothers and sisters in Gaza, Abdullah and his wife Majabeen are choosing to donate their money this Ramadan to the innocent people of Gaza instead of indulging in lavish feasts and excessive spending.
We are dedicating this month of Ramadan to our brothers and sisters in Gaza who are facing so many atrocities. And when I imagine that my brothers and sisters are having their suhoor and iftar with all the bombings and all the sirens of ambulances, it gives me goosebumps.
We as a family can, alhamdulillah, afford enough. But this Ramadan, we have decided to make things very simple, very basic, as much as we can, so that we can, save more money and give more charity to the people of Gaza.
Charitable organizations and grassroots initiatives have launched campaigns to raise funds and collect essential supplies for Gaza's residents. Pakistanis are mobilizing on a large scale, organizing food drives, providing medical aid, and boycotting pro-Israeli products in order to support men, women, and children in Palestine.
Every McDonald's meals that you consume, the dollars are going to buy more ammunition to kill our children. People don't realize it. People don't realize that the Israeli army is getting happy meals every day for free. It's ridiculous.
Throughout the country, mosques and community centers are organizing special prayer sessions dedicated to the well-being and liberation of Gaza.
Through their decision to prioritize the cause of Gaza during Ramadan, Pakistanis are demonstrating the true essence of the Islamic principles of compassion, justice, and charity. This pledge indicates their commitment to turning religious teachings into practical acts of compassion and support for the oppressed and those in need. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Well, several more Palestinians have lost their lives in the latest raids the Israeli forces launched on Tuesday evening on several parts of the occupied West Bank. Mona Candela, our correspondent in Ramallah, joined us earlier with more details. Let's take a listen.
Unfortunately, as you were saying, it seems that in less than 24 hours, the Israeli forces shot and killed six Palestinians all over the occupied West Bank. The latest Palestinian is yet another Palestinian minor, this time 14-year-old Mohammed Abu Hamid from the village of Al-Khadr, South Bethlehem. The Israeli military claimed that Mohammed Abu Hamid arrived on an electric bicycle at the tunnel's checkpoint at the entrance to Al-Quds and near Bethlehem. They claimed that he had a knife and that he succeeded to stab two Israeli soldiers. They were wounded and they are in light to moderate conditions. The Israeli forces then opened fire immediately at this 14-year-old Palestinian. They shot him and killed him and confiscated his body. Earlier, the Israeli forces stormed Jenin refugee camp and the city of Jenin, and the exchange of fire have taken place between the Palestinian fighters and the Israeli forces. Two Palestinians were shot and killed. At least one of them was shot and killed by the Israeli forces while he was inside the complex of the Jenin government hospital, where clashes have been taking place outside the hospital, and the Israeli forces opened fire at the people there at the conflicts of the hospital, and one Palestinian was killed there. Earlier, two Palestinians were shot and killed at the village of Ajib, northwest Al-Quds. The Israelis claimed that a day earlier, Palestinians threw explosive devices or cocktail or Molotov cocktails at the Israeli military checkpoint there. Earlier, there's another Palestinian, this time in Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds, after the, Al-Maghrib and iftar of the second day of Ramadan. He was at the outside his home playing with a number of his relatives. The Israeli forces opened a fire and shot him in the chest. Then they claimed that he was playing with fireworks with the other children, and that's why the Israeli forces opened fire at him, shot him and killed him. The number of the Palestinians who were shot and killed by the Israeli soldiers since the 7th of October is today over 430 Palestinians.
An Israeli drone strike on a car near the southern Lebanese city of Tyre killed a member of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The drone hit the vehicle near the Palestinian refugee camp of Rashidiya. The slain Hamas member has been identified as Hadi Mustafa. According to security sources, a civilian who was passing by on his motorcycle was also killed in the strike. Reports say the Israeli drone was hovered above the site for several minutes before targeting the car. Soon after the strike, sirens were also heard in the occupied territories, indicating possible retaliatory attacks by Lebanon's Hezbollah movement on Israeli targets. Tensions remain high between Hezbollah and Israel since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Both sides have been exchanging fire, but Israel has intensified attacks on civilians in Lebanon in recent weeks. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, to get more on the latest tensions between Israel and Lebanon.
We do not have confirmation or the names of those who were killed in that vehicle, but it is pretty close to one of the Palestinian refugee camps in South Lebanon. It is possible that there is a Palestinian figure that was in the vehicle. It could also be a member of the resistance. We know now that after the strike against this car, sirens were sounding in several areas in the Western Galilee parts. And so that is probably we have those sirens because Hezbollah seems to have launched several rockets. We also know that rockets were fired toward the Golan Heights. That is something that Hezbollah has also maintained is part of its scope of operations as well. But we also know that there's a lot of threats from the Israelis, a lot of talk that they want to go on with a blow against Lebanon, a full-scale war. You have elites within the Israeli regime that are warning of are saying Hezbollah is not going to surrender. It's not the time now for any sort of war against Hezbollah, against Lebanon, while the war in Gaza remains. And he said very clearly this, these elite figures and other political figures also in the Israeli regime are stressing that we all know that Hezbollah is not going to stop until the war in Gaza stops.
A senior Israeli official on the condition of anonymity has revealed that the United States is seeking to oust Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. In a statement issued to the media, the official pointed to a new U.S. intelligence report showing growing public distrust in Netanyahu. He interpreted the wordings in the report as an effort to unseat Netanyahu. The intelligence report for 2024, rather, published on Monday, warned the viability of the Netanyahu cabinet, saying that it may be in jeopardy amid criticism over its handling of the Gaza war. U.S. intelligence agencies in the report also speculated more rallies demanding Netanyahu's resignation and snap elections. The intelligence report and reactions show growing rift between Israel and the U.S. despite Washington's all-out support for the regime's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Moving on, thousands of Iranian legal experts and attorneys have joined the global movement of lawyers who have volunteered to file a genocide complaint against Israel at the International Criminal Court, referred to as the Army of Lawyers for Palestine. The initiative has so far mobilized more than 200,000 lawyers worldwide. Gisumi Shahmadi has the details.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles Devers, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign.
We are witnessing a new movement in the world. The atrocities committed in Gaza are no longer only a matter that concerns Muslim countries. Far from it. Here we have a French lawyer that has started an initiative that brought together 300 lawyers from across the world in less than 10 days, and that number grew rapidly to 100,000. And now with the MOU that we have signed at the Iran Judiciary Bar, that number will be rising to 50,000 lawyers. With Iran on board, you can also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
And an optimistic Gilles de Verre, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true, because the humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why, while the South African government files a complaint, we see a grassroots movement also taking shape, a very unique one that has brought together lawyers who are seeking justice in the battle between good and evil.
And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach. These lawyers believe that we live in a new era, in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why is the month of Ramadan superior to other months? May 19th, 2018. We should move forward and we should accompany our movement with divine intentions and with the intention of getting closer to God. We should know that if we apply these methods, God's assistance and blessings will be definite. The month of Ramadan is an opportunity for gaining piety, and the purpose of fasting is that you may learn piety. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 183. Allah, the Exalted, has commanded us to fast with this purpose in mind. At least one of the purposes of commanding people to fast during this month, fasting is one of the important characteristics of the month of Ramadan, is to exercise piety. In daily du'as, after saying prayers, we read, "And this is a month on which you bestowed greatness, dignity, and honor, and on which you bestowed superiority over other months." Allah, the Exalted, has made this month superior to others. One of the reasons for this superiority is the act of fasting. Another reason is that He sent down the Holy Quran in this month. Another reason is the night of Qadr. These things have been mentioned in this dua as characteristics of this month. This is good ground for our growth and fruitfulness. It is like the springtime. As each season of the year has certain natural characteristics, some seasons and sometimes days, nights, weeks, and months have certain characteristics for growth and for the spiritual dynamism and the transcendence of the people.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Dear friends, the month of Ramadan is a very good opportunity. It is a very good opportunity. It is an opportunity to do promotions, promoting Islamic values, to clarify, to get close to the people, to help the poor, and above all, to worship God, to fast, to sit at the table of divine mercy and divine banquet. This well-known banquet is your act of fasting, engaging in nafila, prayers which are not obligatory, and saying daily prayers.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
On June 18, 1994, when Francisco Oscar Lamolina, the referee of the opening game of the World Cup, blew into the whistle, over 77,000 spectators were shouting in jeers at Pontiac Silverdome Stadium in Detroit. It was the first time that the World Cup was being held in the U.S. For a month, all eyes all over the world were fixated at the event. The shining stars of the world of football, like Romario, Roberto Baggio, Hristo Stoichkov, and Gheorghe Hagi filled the stadiums to the brim. With every goal, yellow or red cards, the stadiums were in uproar, like the day when Nigeria thrashed Bulgaria with 3 goals and the fans of the team were madly shouting out of joy. People who had traveled thousands of miles from Africa so they could watch the games up close. Those days were good days for the people in Africa, but not for all the residents of the continent. Right at the time when people across the world were glued to their television sets to watch Nigeria's exhilarating display of skills, in a part of Africa, one of the most brutal genocide in the history of mankind was underway. The Tutsi and Hutu tribes in Rwanda were up in arms against each other. In 100 days, 1 million people, nearly 20% of the population of the country, were killed. The Hutus that had control over the government killed so many people from ethnic Tutsis that the tribe lost 75% of its population. The genocide eventually stopped after the UN intervention, but it proved that death in Africa is an ordinary thing that can take place. However, the genocide in Rwanda wasn't the largest massacre Africa was witnessing. In the 60s, amid the French occupation of Algeria, over 1.5 million people died in the country within a span of 2 years only for asking for independence. If you think it was the bloodiest incident in Africa, you'd better go through the history of Belgium, a small country that perks in Western Europe and is shown in a light of democracy and freedom these days. But in the not-too-distant past, it experienced one of the most horrifying governments in history. Leopold II, the former Belgian king, who ruled over the country from 1865 to 1909, occupied the Congo in Africa. During the 44 years of occupation, he slaughtered over 10 million people in the Central African country. Yet, despite the high number of killing, Leopold II is not on top of the list of the biggest murderers in history. As it was announced in the 60s and 70s, the biggest and scariest murderer in Africa, unlike what the majority of the people in the world imagine, was a woman. The number of the people this woman put to death is higher than the number of the people killed by Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and even Genghis Khan put together. Even higher than the number of the people who were killed during the bombing of Dresden in Germany, and the victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear bombing. Apparently, Rachel Carson is the biggest murderer in history, and yet nobody was aware for a long time. Everyone admired Carson for being a nice human being and a great author, and also for her role as an environmental activist. She has been praised in numerous books, articles, and reports, but in the end, the mask was removed from her face. They said that the woman who had a charming smile on her face in all of the pictures and the only thing she cared about was nature was behind the death of millions of people in Africa. The deaths happened after she genetically modified mosquitoes. If we take a look at history, we'll find out that Rachel Carson's life in many ways had striking similarity with major criminals throughout history, like Hitler, who used to paint pictures when he was a young man, or Stalin, who was a choir singer. Carson was into art, literature, and poetry. She was born in Pennsylvania and graduated from Johns Hopkins University in 1932. After getting a degree in zoology, she started her career as a journalist. 15 years later, she displayed so much talent and skills in the field of aquatic creatures that she supervised all publications in this field. During those years, she tried books besides working as a journalist. Her books are on environment and the seas, which gained Carson fame. She resigned from all of her posts in 1952, so she could concentrate mainly on writing books. The most important book she wrote in that period was her autobiography. The U.S. media, as well as many chemists and physicians, say the book changed the fate of millions of people in African and many other parts of the world. Carson's name turned into the nightmare of people who were grappling with malaria.
In Africa and Asia, the mosquito is a mass killer. More than 2 million people die every year from malaria, which mosquitoes transmit.
In 1962, Carson's Silent Spring was published. In her book, she has talked about the detrimental health hazards on pesticides on food and agricultural products, and that the widespread use of DDT helps the poisonous substance permeate into plants and remain in their texture for a long time and cause disease. They say the publication of the book and raising such issues banned the use of DDT across the world, including in Africa. But the ban in Africa led to the emergence of an old disease across the continent. Back then, many chemists criticized Carson for her theory and claimed it was basically unfounded.
In Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. Her suggestion that pesticides are in fact biocides destroying all life is obviously absurd in the light of the fact that without selective biological activity, these compounds would be completely useless.
Based on figures and documents proposed by Dr. Gordon Edwards, an entomologist at the University of San Jose in California, stated in his paper that the elimination of DDT helped the mosquitoes that transit malaria to reproduce without any barriers. In a few years, the population of the mosquitoes grew so large that millions of Africans fell victim to the disease and lost their lives, according to Edwards in an article titled Bias, Misinformation, Half-Truth, published in 1992 in the Science and Technology magazine. The Silent Spring has been one of the deadliest books in history as it sent millions of people in Africa to their death. Some people put the number of fatalities at about 50 million people, larger than the number of the casualties in the Second World War. DDT was first synthesized in 1874 by Othmar Zeidler, but insecticidal properties were not identified until World War II. But from 1939, it was widely used by soldiers on farms to fight off lice and typhus. Major chemical companies produced millions of tons of DDT every year and earned whopping amounts of profits. So it was only natural that the companies were outraged over the ban imposed on production and sales of DDT. Therefore, when Rachel Carson published her book, they spent about $250,000 to debunk her claims.
Measures which research laboriously has developed.
In the media, they called her a radical, hysterical spinster who only keeps cats and hates genetics. It was at that time when Carson was introduced as the biggest criminal in history who caused the deaths of millions of people. Even today, the claim continues to be circulated by some people, but the reality is Rachel Carson was never a criminal or murderer. In fact, the ban on consumption of DDT has nothing to do with her. In fact, 5 years before Carson's Silent Spring was published, the United States Environmental Protection Agency reached the conclusion that using DDT has detrimental effects on humans' health.
A government-backed scientific panel today reported that pesticides may indeed represent a grave threat to mankind.
The average American already has more DDT in his body than is permitted in the meat and fish that we eat. It does not go away, it accumulates, and it passes to babies through their mother's milk.
So the consumption of chemical substance sharply declined from 1957 to 1967, and in 1979, it was completely banned. At that time, it was revealed that DDT is not effective in killing malaria because they quickly adapt themselves to the insecticides. In fact, now everyone knows that Carson and malaria are irrelevant. But powerful businesses and political lobbies in the 60s and 70s grilled the scientists for her studies, and many people detested her. It has happened many times through history. Rachel Carson is only one example of politicizing science.
We have heard a great deal about their safety, but very little about the hazards, very little about the failures, the inefficiencies. And yet the public was being asked to accept these chemicals, was being asked to acquiesce in their use, and did not have the whole picture. So I set about to remedy the balance there.
In 1898, German medical student Hermann Rottmann announced that tobacco causes infection and tumor in the lungs. Laborers at tobacco fields were exposed to the highest risk. He continued to hold to the wrong belief until 1912, when some doctors tied lung diseases to smoking cigarettes. In the 1920s, when lung cancer was being identified, it was attributed to various agents like asphalt and the effects of poisonous gases in World War I. Smoking cigarettes did not have an outstanding place on the list. But in 1939, Hermann Müller in the Cologne University in Germany studied 86 patients with lung cancer and publicly announced the relationship between smoking and the disease. The idea was soon approved by the scientists in the US and Britain, as well as the American Cancer Society. The news was a massive shock to the tobacco industry all over the world, and their shares at the stock markets plunged. Six major cigarette-producing companies decided to find a way out of the crisis. On December 14, 1953, the directors of the companies gathered in the Hotel Plaza in Manhattan and told the reporters that the alleged link between smoking and lung cancer needs further scientific research. They announced that the claim that cigarette is a carcinogen is unfounded, and there are no scientific proof to back the claim. Those who stood up against tobacco companies would face harsh reactions from the companies and the scientists affiliated with the companies.
Four packs of cigarettes a day. I am 55. Yeah! Wait a second. Tell me if I don't look 20 years younger than this.
These people were on many radio and television shows. Their message to the audience was, we're not sure if smoking cigarettes can cause cancer. In fact, the doubt ruled the minds of the people. This is known as the trade of doubt.
This is America today. The pace fast, the competition great. We live with more tension, more emotion, more concern about our health, more everything than ever before.
In 1979, a promotional video footage named Smoking and Health, The Need to Know, was made and broadcast by tobacco companies. The video was played for hundreds of thousands of Americans. During the screening time and after that, the audience was posed with some questions. They were asked, is it likely that the concerns raised over smoking and the health hazards are wrong? A year after the survey, they achieved unbelievable results. There was a 17% decline in the number of those who already believed that smoking can cause cancer. It nosedived to 59% from 76%. The survey was conducted in other countries like Britain and the Netherlands. In the 1980s, Philip Morris spent millions of dollars to persuade the people in the UK that they should not worry about secondhand smoking. Meanwhile, a study conducted in the Netherlands in 2011 showed that 61% of the people in the country believe that smoking poses no threats to non-smokers, while throughout these years, many doctors and scientists have tried to prove to the people that smoking, cigarettes and nicotine can be very hazardous and can lead to many diseases like lung cancer. They published different kinds of figures to push back those who capitalize on doubt. But those who were on the other side of the story, namely tobacco factories and their affiliated scientists, wielded huge power. Now it has come to light that the scientists knew for decades that cigarettes and its compounds are very hazardous for human body. The documents leaked in the 1980s and 1990s by some tobacco company staff revealed that the owners of the companies had known as an established fact from the 1950s that smoking can cause cancer. In one of these documents dated 1953, Claude Thigaud, one of the scientific advisors of Camel Tobacco Company, wrote to his director that the tobacco in cigarettes is one of the main factors behind lung cancer and added that there is a direct correlation between smoking and lung cancer. A decade before that, Emma Harris Palmer, the head of the research center of Lord Yard, acknowledged that there is ample evidence to prove the link between smoking and lung cancer.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, it is the holy month of Ramadan. What a beautiful month to be able to witness in our lifetimes. And really, it is a grace and a blessing on behalf of the Almighty Allah, the Exalted, the Compassionate, the Merciful. The love of our life, the Almighty Allah, who has given us yet another opportunity and another chance in our lives to be able to witness this holy month of Ramadan. Now, we all know that it is difficult, and of course, when we're being honest, we know it is difficult to fast from the morning until the Maghrib, from before the Fajr prayers, or at least starting at the Fajr prayers. Technically, at Fajr, we're supposed to stop eating. But anyways, we're not talking about the very specific jurisprudential aspects. But from, you know, Suhoor until Iftar, we are fasting. From the morning until the night, we are fasting. This is really very difficult.
And nobody is denying that it is difficult. But of course, you know, we also find that there's many countless rewards. And really, to a certain, in certain traditions, we find that the rewards are probably not capable of being calculated. There are so many rewards. And even though, yes, some of us might fast in the holy month of Ramadan, these obligatory fasting that Muslims have to do, unless they have some kind of health conditions. But this obligatory fasting these are the rewards. And what we were saying is that even though we don't necessarily, you know, fast for rewards or fear of punishment, but we fast for the satisfaction and the contentment and, you know, the rizayat, this kind of happiness, if you will, or this contentment of the Almighty Allah. But anyways, talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence was always very cheerful. Sometimes we have this kind of an idea that the Imams were very, I guess, I don't know, ultra serious or very frown face all the time, when in reality they were very beautiful faces. They were very honorable faces. When you would look at their faces, you would feel this sense of joy and happiness and the sense of peace and tranquility, very serene faces, not at all what we sometimes think about them to be. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about this idea of cheerfulness, and he talks about how it creates love, it creates friendship, and something, you know, as simple as a smile is something that is, you know, leads to cheerfulness, it leads to happiness in the society. You know, even the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, said that, you know, the simplest and most basic form of charity is a smile. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam here is also talking about smiling and being cheerful. So let's connect the two. In the holy month of Ramadan, if nothing else, why don't we try to smile more often and try to be cheerful and positive a little bit more often in this holy month of Ramadan, and follow one of these very subtle teachings, if you will, of Imam Ali alayhi salam, a very beautiful and profound lesson indeed for us all, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'ayi واقبل ثناي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
Thank you.
And now we invite you to listen to Fayyaz Ja'far.
I thought to reflect upon one of the most important aspects of the legacy of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, and that is, of course, the letter of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayh, toward his companion Malik al-Ashtar. This particular letter, as we know, has its own unique merit, has been reflected, has been studied, has been researched by a wide variety of different academic bodies. And politicians throughout history have spoken toward the merit of the words of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, something that probably every single one of us is very aware about. But when it comes deep down into it, it's really important for us to actually read the letter of the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam, because it's far beyond, far more comprehensive than that one line that all of us have memorized, that people are of two types. أَمَّا أَخٌ لَكَ فِي الدِّينِ أَوْ نَذِيرٌ لَكَ فِي الْخَلْقِ, that people are of two types, either your brother in faith or your equal in humanity. The words of Ali ibn Abi Talib within this letter toward Malik al-Ashtar, as narrated by many of the scholars, they state that if someone wants to make a difference in the world, they should take a portion of every single day toward reading a little bit of this letter of the commander of the faithful toward Malik al-Ashtar. And in reality, yes, it is very lengthy, but nonetheless, it's something of the utmost importance in terms of where our mindsets need to be, specifically in light, again, of the socio-political climate that we're living in within this country, within this world, as Muslims and as followers of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salatu wa-salam. So firstly, when you want to try our very best to understand a man like Malik al-Ashtar, it's incredibly important for us to understand the idea of context. The way that the imams, that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would speak to their companions, toward their followers, would vary. We know a narration that states, كَلَّمَ النَّاسَ عَلَىٰ قَدَرَ أُقُولِهِمْ, speak to people according to their own intellects, to the levels of their capacity of thinking. Thus, the way that the Prophet speaks toward Imam Ali alayhi salam is very different than the way that the Prophet would speak to Abu Dharr al-Ghaffari, or the way that the Prophet would speak to Salman, or the way that the Prophet would speak to Bilal. Because the ma'rifah, the knowledge, the understanding, the wisdom of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen is far different than anyone else. Which is why Salman, for instance, in the narration he states, and we know that the Prophet would state that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has divided faith into 10 parts, and Salman is on the 10th level of Iman. And even then, Salman, he would narrate that when I would look at the actions of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, sometimes I would have no idea what he was doing, why he was doing it. So where was Ali in relation to Salman? In reality, there's no comparison. But we see that the way that the Prophet would speak to him is very different, again, than he would speak to other companions. Why do certain individuals, why are certain individuals recipients of such divine knowledge from Ahlul Bayt while others are not? In reality, it comes down toward their submission toward their Imam. For instance, when we see the relationship of Imam Ali and Kumail ibn Ziyad, if you open up Nahj al-Balagha, or if you just Google any, you know, conversation between Imam Ali and Kumail, sometimes you read the conversation and in reality you have absolutely no idea what the Imam was telling Kumail ibn Ziyad. It's way beyond our minds, way beyond our intellects. Why does a personality, for instance, like Abu Hamza al-Thamali, why is he the recipient of the dua of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam? It's because of their devotion toward their Imam and the unique knowledge and station that they had in relation toward the infallible.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.